Six members of the class of 1954 are gathered at the Colonial Inn on September 24, 2004 to do an oral history of their time, and they will serve as a window to their era 50 years ago. The interview is being done by Renee Garalick and for Concord's Oral History Program. I'm going to go around the table and ask each of you to state your name, where you live now, and where you lived growing up in Concord.
My name is David Casey. Currently I live in Huntington Beach, California. And in Concord, I lived on Crescent Road.
My name is Hazel Maxine Fult Gritches. I was Hazel Maxine Fulton in high school. I now live in Monterey, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires. And growing up, I was on Walden Street.
I'm Bob Downey. Grew up, I guess we talk about what we did first. I mean, where we are now, I'm from New York City and other places, but mostly New York City. And when I lived in Concord, I lived at 49 Lexington Road.
I probably should also ask you to state your profession. So why don't you begin that, Bob, and then I'll go back.
Investment banking.
And Dave?
A physician.
Retired.
Okay. All right, now we're up to you, Dorothy.
I'm Dorothy DiCicco. I now live in Acton. Lived on Belknap Street when I lived in Concord, and I'm retired.
My name is Dominic Inverara. Born and brought up in the town. I live on 49 Shadyside Avenue. And I've been a heavy equipment operator in my time and a truck driver.
I'm Barbara Pereira McGuigan, and I lived on Sudbury Road when we lived in Concord. I live in Stratham, New Hampshire at this time, and I'm Director of Development Research for the University of New Hampshire Foundation.
Thank you. I'm going to start with you, Dominic, if you could describe the family farm.
Yeah, well, my mom and dad came from Italy. Back in 1925, I believe. I was born and raised here, a family of four. Made a living growing mostly strawberries and asparagus in the town of Concord, and running a roadside stand.
On Lexington?
On Lexington Road. And still going today, as a matter of fact. But basically, born and brought up on a farm.
Now, your interests, like trapping, were part of...
Now, when I was growing up, yes, I was enthused in hunting and trapping also. Used to go check the traps early in the morning before school sometimes, you know, but that was quite a few years ago. And been a member of the Concord Rod and Gun Club for... since I was 17 years old, I don't remember what date, and interested in conservation all these years. So.
And that was part of your hunting interest?
Yes, it was. It was.
Hazel?
Maxine.
Okay. Your father was the county extension agent?
Yes. Was the Middlesex County Extension agent that also covered the state of Massachusetts called Fruit, but he was the Middlesex agent for the fruit and vegetables. And he used to go to Dominic's dad,
mm-hmm.
and he would help if they had a problem with how to grow, get their bugs. And the Extension Service at that time was over by the playground.
Emerson?
Right, Emerson.
And his first name?
Max.
So you had an introduction, to all of the agricultural needs.
Yes, we did, and he knew everybody around who had a farm, whatever. So when he would go to help, and then he would always come home with fresh vegetables, fresh corn, and people like to always load them up.
Yeah.
So he got around. But, and then when he retired, he had a big dinner going on there.
So Concord was very much of a farming community then. Any of you want to comment on that? In your neighborhood, it was not built up like today.
No, my neighborhood was not. Crescent Road was, it still is, I don't think they moved it, off of Elm Street, but it was just one or two roads from there, and I understand now that built up and lots of other developments around there. My only connection with a farm is when I was a kid, I used to go as a kid, I'm trying to remember how old I was, but ancient times, but I was picked up by a farmer at the depot, and a bunch of kids would get on this truck in the morning, and we'd all go and work the fields and then come back at night, and it was kind of an interesting couple of summers I did, probably fifth or sixth grade or something like that, and we'd hoe corn and pick beets, wash beets and pack them, and we'd send them off to the to Faneuil Hall, and it was only up until a year ago I could never stand beets, and I started now. Now I can finally eat a beet without too much discomfort. But it was a lot of fun. It was a good way to nice, healthy outdoor life. And we did not have a farm,
but it was a wooded area.
Oh yeah, it was a wooded area, and where from my house I could walk quite a way. All the way to the railroad track. There were no homes there. It was all woods, a couple small ponds, and everything. You could see stuff, and, you know, birds and small animals, skunks, stuff like that. It was semi-rural, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked on a farm, picking strawberries. I remember that. That was long days.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and where we lived, my family built a house on Sudbury Road, and there were no new homes around. It was the only new house. And behind us was all just fields, farm across the street. We could smell the manure in the spring when they put that out. And pheasants everywhere. I had mm-hmm. Irish water spaniel, and it went crazy because we had pheasants in the backyard. Now that whole area is built up.
Now you can't find a pheasant in the town. I mean, there used to be plenty of them. The Rod and Gun Club every year used to distribute about 30, 50 birds just for the sake of hunting. Mm-hmm. And they used to come down to our farm to let them out because we had plenty of cover and food that left over corn stalks and stuff that the pheasants really enjoyed, and there used to be plenty of them, but now you can't find them. There are other animals, like this morning I saw five turkeys in my backyard. Mm-hmm. Wild turkey. When I was growing up, never saw a wild turkey. You know, but they're there, and there's a lot of deer around, only because you just can't hunt anymore. You know, the land is so congested that there's not enough open land to hunt, because you have to be within 500 feet of a dwelling or a road. So it was an article in the Globe this morning about that, how there's so many animals around now that just because you cannot hunt them. Mm-hmm. The number of hunters have been decreased big time over the whole state, because of the growing.
Dorothy, your neighborhood on Belknap Street, it was a very close-knit neighborhood.
Yes, it was. Neighbor, new neighbor. I mean, you could visit each other. If your mother went out of town, you know, to Boston, your next-door neighbor would, you know, welcome you into her home. We did. We got along. Everybody got along very well.
And that was known as the back of the depot.
Back of the depot,
neighborhood.
Yes.
And ethnically, it was
Italian, Irish, and there were a couple Scandinavian families. The behind our house, there was a Scandinavian family. He was a carpenter. He did carpentry work with my grandfather. And it was very, as I say, a close-knit family here. Would go off and leave your door unlocked and nobody would bother you, or it was just one of those quote, really, say, as I say, close-knit.
Really?
Everybody got along with each other. There wasn't any of this troubles in neighborhoods that you read about now in the papers.
And everything I've always heard about your neighborhood supports that. That's wonderful. Right now, as we are assembled at this point of time, football is the big thing, and certainly in high school, the football games were a major event. But right now, the historic record of Concord's winning football team under Bernie Meegan. Now, some of the newspapers put 1948 to 52. Sometimes it's extended a little later in the 50s. But Bob, you remember that.
Yeah, it wasn't that it was extended later in the 50s. It definitely ended in 52.
Mm-hmm.
We lost two games in 52, which would have been my junior year. But I thought that it started in 46, not 48. And there will be people that we will meet in the unmentionable reunion who will know better than I. But I thought the record was 46 or 49, not the 40 that we hear. But that may just be a clouded memory or whatever. But the interesting thing to me was that Concord at that time, of course, so famous for the revolution starting here and so famous for the transcendentalists in the middle of the 19th century. These were the things, the Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Alcott, and so forth. But for us, at that time, I'm speaking for myself now, not the rest of the group, the football was critically important. The winning streak and just the traditions here in Concord of how the high school football was everything. As I say, we lost two games my junior year, but we were undefeated again my senior. That would have been the fall of 1953. And it meant so much to me. I had a brother who was at Andover, and Dad wanted me to join him there or some other place, and there was no way you could tear me away from this place. And it had not, wasn't just the great academics or the traditions and history of the town. It was definitely that tradition of winning football. And
how the community supported
it. Oh, the community. Well,
the community.
Was
Thanksgiving Day,
that's
I remember.
Very good,
Thanksgiving morning, that game against Lexington. I mean, everybody went to, whether you're a child or knew anybody on the team that had nothing to do with it. And then you remember the games that were played in the South that they raised money to send the football team down to the Winston-Salem.
That was during the streak.
That was during the streak, and that was an amazing thing.
Yeah.
That people, donated money to send the team down to
Winston-Salem postseason game.
That's what impressed
me. Point.
Yeah.
You were telling me, Bob, that many Catholics, students who were on the team would actually go to Mass prior.
Yeah, well, it was just kind of what we did in those days. It wasn't making a huge statement. It was just of course, the games are on Saturday and Fridays you couldn't eat meat in those days, so you'd start off with a steak in the morning if you could get it. Not that the school could provide it, but if you could get it at home after Mass, so you'd go there and you'd have a big, that was the theory in those days, get a lot of meat in you, and then you'd be stronger in the game that afternoon. That little church, it's still there, which we all attended, not all, but perhaps
St. Bernard's?
Yeah.
Well, Our Ladies is closing in West Concord October 25th.
They closed down a lot of churches.
Yeah, that will be a big change, and it's going down hard.
Yeah.
very hard. But this next Friday night is when Acton Boxborough High School's football team will meet Concord Carlisle's football team, you know, to see if the record will stay or be broken. So it's a big event.
which record?
Exactly.
Well, the Boston Globe says the 40 consecutive wins, but we'll just call it the streak.
I thought it was much more than 40.
I thought it was 60.
I thought it was 49.
I thought it was 54. Maybe that's the year we graduated. But
and maybe 46 is because that was the year it started. But if you went 46 to 52, I think you'd come up with more than 40 games.
Yeah, no, I think it was over. Oh, I thought it was over 50. But I remember it as Bob was saying, a really, and others were saying, a really interesting statement when we went down to North Carolina. And we were champions of what? C division, or
it might have even been D.
D division.
I think it was D division.
And we played the AAA or whatever it was division of North Carolina for the Piedmont Bowl. And I remember getting off the train and smelling tobacco smoke. I thought, my God, these evil people down there.
We were in tobacco country.
Tobacco country, yeah, but they treated us wonderfully down there. I was not a player. I was not that talented, but I was smart enough to become a manager. Avoided, you know, bodily injury, and allowed me to travel with the team, and I had fun with that. So it was a great camaraderie.
I believe all the cheerleaders.
Well, Charlie Mayo was the manager too, wasn't he?
Yeah, Charlie and I.
Yeah, you and Charlie.
Didn't all the cheerleaders go down to that game?
Well, there were people that went down.
I don't know if the cheerleaders went along.
Cheerleaders, I don't think they at least not as a group.
Yeah, we had a lot of folks went down on the train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we gathered to say everybody goodbye. But I thought it was interesting that the community responded to the football team in high school. I wonder if it's the same interest today that the community had in the high school, not just the football team, but in the activities of the high school, and you know, we're proud of what happened in terms of
the plays,
the concerts, certainly the plays.
I was in the band at the time, so I wasn't in the football team, but I was on the high school band, and I don't believe we didn't get a chance to go down for that, but we practiced every Wednesday out on the field. To get ready for Saturday's game, you know, to make do our letters out there in the field and all. So it was quite interesting. It was a drummer, by the way.
Oh. Do any of you remember Bernie Meekin or John O'Connell?
Yeah.
Want to say anything?
He was a legend.
Yes, he was.
He was a legend in his own time. Yeah. He really was. He was a motivating guy. And he was a good coach. I was always surprised that he, and I guess the probably reasons for that why he didn't move on to college ranks, but I don't know whether it was his choice or what. You know anything about that?
I thought
he could do it. I always thought.
Yeah, I think he could have done it. I mean, he had the Notre Dame tradition. He had played for Notre Dame, and he was a very inspiring coach, no question about that. But he also had two terrific assistants in Walter Carew. And John O'Donnell.
Mm-hmm.
O'Donnell on the line.
Yeah.
Oh, these guys were great. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at this old article here. I was trying to look and see if it said anything. This was in 1953, if it said anything about the streak. But it did say something about, I mean, you know, Meekin is interviewed here, and he talks about his assistants. And they were great. So it was just, I mean, in those days, now you have, you know, all kinds of special coaches for everything, in every position, it's hard to believe. But then, you know, to have three coaches of that caliber, I mean, Meekin was number one, no question, was quite an amazing thing. And there were some other, you know, now and then assistants or part-time people, but to have that kind of depth and talent in coaching.
It was my understanding, too, that he didn't go on to college because of the streak, and he was having such success. He really enjoyed the talk, but he didn't go.
Yeah, that, you may be right.
Had he gone to school in Notre Dame?
I believe so.
Yeah. He had a large family, too, I think.
Yes.
Eight children or something like that.
Also, the band always had to play the Notre Dame fight song.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
We didn't think it was that bothersome.
Yeah.
Well, certainly community, you know, as a focus was very strong then. But family life, you know, some of you related to me that the family ate together or Sunday dinners. Do you want to comment on that?
Oh, absolutely. You always had dinner, at least in our family, together. No matter what you were doing, if you were up in sports, whatever, you had to be home at dinner time. And going to church together was another thing that my family, Sunday morning, we had to be there. We all went to church together. And there were a lot of, in our family, there were a lot of events, family-centered, family-oriented. You know, it was, I think it was unusual in those days for the mother to be working, so you had that kind of atmosphere where family was always there.
We always had Sunday afternoons, because we always went to church, and then when we came home, then my mother would start to make the afternoon dinner, because we had one meal in the afternoon, a big one, and whoever was around stayed, so she never knew how many was going to be there, so we always had turkey pot pie. And her pies, though, we had her pies. And we could have had anywhere between 5 and 10 people if she never knew.
Now, you mentioned church. How did Protestants and Catholics get along then? Was there any problems,
no,
or
no.
It was fine?
I had a friend, and I haven't had any problems.
Okay.
I don't think it really came up, you know, for
it wasn't
the most
an issue.
Part. It seemed to.
I am going to say something here. I'm sorry, Hazen, because Ellen and I were talking about it. Our whole life revolved around what someone else had to do. And as far as dating was concerned, when you all had to be home because you were going to go to confession, they had to be home at midnight, you couldn't eat after midnight, dating stopped. And everybody went home. Whatever religion you were, and no one questioned it at all.
In the Stations of the Cross, and every Friday afternoon, thank you guys, being Protestant, everybody I knew went to Stations of the Cross, and I didn't have to wait for them.
They didn't invite you in?
No. They didn't think I knew what to say.
I didn't make them, so.
Actually,
I was outside with you, Hades.
Actually, it was 50 years ago that you can say the advent of television, you know, arrived. And that changed the dynamics. For a while, it brought families together. And I think you mentioned that you all watch things together.
Right.
Dorothy.
On Saturday evening, we used to watch Gunsmoke and a couple of other programs. And then on Sunday, I believe it was the Colgate Comedy Hour. So we were always sat there together, watched these programs. And of course, we only had, what, 3 channels, 4, 5, and 7? And of course, the news would be on.
And you were one of the first in your
neighborhood to get a television. And I remember it was this great big, presenter. And the screen itself was probably only about a 12-inch screen, but you know, you had a big piece of furniture. And then black and white, then you didn't get color television until several years later.
Wrote to me that it did lessen the family conversation as you were all with your little trays.
Absolutely. I think that it did. Certainly in our house, at least, changed the dynamics of the dinner meal, or Sunday particularly, if it was like at Sullivan or something like that that came on, then the TV trays, at least in our house, would come out and we would, you know, sit in the washing this tube, which was, as you said, very small, and eat while you're watching. And it probably changed a lot of the dynamics. The conversation changed, you know, or the lack of conversation. I think that was a big event in terms of family dynamics in America. TV changed that.
Well, I remember, you know, sitting down, having supper, and watching the clock and saying, oh, 10 minutes, I've got 10 minutes to do the dishes, and do, you know, run in to watch a program. And, you know, my father would be in watching the news, and we'd say, okay, now it's such and such a time, we're going to watch our programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I remember always, every Sunday, you could not go near the television, because that during the spring and summer, it was baseball season. Then came football season, and we could not disturb him during that. After the games were over, then he said, "Now you can watch your program."
we were one of the very last to get a TV, and that was because kind of the dynamic you were talking about, David, where, you know, if you're all watching TV, you're not participating, you're not having conversations and so forth. And my father had instituted something for our family that was about fading about this time, but we had started when we were much younger. And that is because before television, the idea is we could not, my brothers nor I, could not go to a movie unless we had read a book and given a book report, or learned some poetry of To Be or Not to Be, or the Declaration of Independence, or something like that. And of course, my father would give these assignments, and then my mother had to hear us, you know, and read it. I mean, he was great at giving assignments. So he instilled that in us, and that would obviously, it was fading anyway, just because of other interests by then. At the start, we were much younger. But television was obviously not going to be conducive to that. So we resisted, he did. Getting a television tour. I guess we were probably among the last in our community to get one. By the way, I never did that with my kids, and I always kind of regretted it. And maybe it's the difference in the family. In other words, I never had my kids have to, you know, read books and give book reports the way my father did. And yet, it was a wonderful thing for me. I mean, I can still recite the Declaration of Independence, To Be or Not to Be, things like that. It stays with you for a lifetime. So it's a wonderful idea, but I never adapted myself. I was just too busy with life. I mean, that's because life was different when we were bringing up our kids. You just didn't have time for this. You met at different times, you ate at different times. So.
Maybe the night we sat and listened to radio.
Yeah.
I can remember
that's
with
right.
my ear to one of those old radios.
The Shadow?
The Shadow and all those, what was it? Superman, I think, and a couple of those radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't
the
wait
Green
to
Hornet.
Get there with our ear glued to the thing just to listen to it.
Just a squeaking door.
That's right.
But, you know, something that Dottie said that occurred to me, that were so few channels that we were all watching the same programs. and the community, you know, knew about the same programs.
Yeah.
You know, the Isle of Lucy, what happened, or whatever that, and it was something did have an impact on sort of conversations in general in the community, whereas today with 140 stations, you don't have that same common background and interests.
Well, back then, if you missed the program, say you were out or whatever, you could always ask your neighbor what happened. You know, like I Love Lucy, or what happened in Gunsmoke, it was a continuation of
Milton Berle was the biggest.
Yeah.
Everybody's
yeah.
waited for, I don't know, what was it, a Tuesday night maybe?
Yeah.
It was a special night for Milton Berle show. And that went on. You wouldn't miss that one. I remember going to the neighbor just to see that before we got a TV.
Oh,
we
yeah.
were lucky enough to go to a neighbor
yeah.
to
yeah.
see it.
Now, the movies and, I mean, certainly the popularity of the movies, but no movie theater in Concord.
No way.
Well, we used to go.
They had one
Melon.
Yeah,
we went to Maynard.
That's right.
Our Boston.
Waltham.
Yeah. Waltham. Yeah.
What was that building down Concord there that on occasion?
Oh, down the Veterans Building.
The Veterans Building
used to
have
movies on
Sunday afternoons, I think, for kids and stuff.
That's true.
Saturday after, I think it was Saturday afternoon for a dime or something like that.
We had the Girl Scouts, and we were raising money for our troop to go down to Washington, so we put on movies at the Girl Scout house for the little kids on Saturday mornings, and we made lollipops and popcorn and balloons, and we raised a lot of money.
We were called Senior Social Scouts. And the reason why it really did attract us, and we were the first candy stripers at Emerson Hospital.
That's right.
And had our picture in the National Journal of Hospitals or whatever, because we were the first.
That's when there was just the one building at the hospital.
And her mother was one of the Girl Scout leaders. Quite an interesting program we had. We didn't get the badges, but we did a lot of community work, volunteer work.
You wrote to me that, Maxine, that you had raised the money to go to Washington, and the big thrill was having...
meeting John F. Kennedy, and he had his picture taken with us as a group on the Capitol stairs, I believe it was. And then he autographed all of our pictures for us.
He was senator then.
Yes, he was.
Oh, I should have brought the picture. I have a picture of you with Senator Kennedy that I took, a snapshot I still have. And we were disappointed at the time because Senator Saltonstall was the senior senator, and he wasn't available, so this junior senator. And of course, when we met him, we all just fell in love with him because he was so handsome and so dynamic, and he spent several hours with us, taking us through the Senate. And we went on the train and so forth, and that was quite something. And he talked to us about how important it was for us to, you know, get involved with our community, to study history, to... he really was very different on a one-to-one basis than he was on television. He was very quiet, very serious, very... just very friendly, don't you think?
Yeah, oh yeah. And he was very patient, gave us a lot of time. We were impressed about that.
That's great. By the way, do you remember the leading movie 50 years ago? Or the one that got Best Picture. This actor who got Best Actor Award then died this year.
Oh, on the waterfront. Oh, Marlon
Brando.
That's right.
Oh, sure, Brando, yeah.
Yeah. Could have been a contender.
I don't remember what year, but they made a movie in Concord.
Never Too Late.
Never Too Late was an, it was done up in Mishnack Hill or Mishottak Hill in that area.
That was
the whole town was
a little later. That was around 1960.
60.
Also, the automobile, I mean, it was a time when that really was impacting life. And you said it was a big thrill to get your driver's license.
Enormous thrill. Yeah, it was one that, you know, it did change your life. Before you had your driver's license, you were obviously dependent upon some older sibling, if you're lucky, or friend. Older sibling who could drive you to such exotic places as Waltham or Boston or Newton or wherever else, or even a Maynard to see a movie. So when you got your license, it was quite an event. And, freedom, basically. That is freedom if you could ever get your dad to let you drive the car, which was a little bargain there to be able to do that.
Yeah, and that was different than today because it was unusual to have a second car.
Absolutely.
That teenagers could have.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of bargaining with the parents to get the car. And anybody who had their own car, that was really big. Sheila Doherty,
well,
I think, had her dog.
Sheila Doherty had
and there are several other classmates.
Covert Denson.
Yeah, it was an old car. But that was an old car. That was really cool.
Yeah, really had a car.
Yeah.
How different it is today when most families have two, three, you know, how many cars. Kids think they need to have a car.
Yeah.
There was only half a dozen in the parking lot when we went to school. Everybody used to hang out the other side. And there was probably half a dozen cars that the only ones
The high school parking lot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was able to, you know, kids that had school sometimes had parents' cars on occasion, you know.
Since we're mentioning the high school, do you want to explain how regional it was in terms of towns?
You mean the different towns?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we had Carlisle came, Bedford came, and then there was Concord, West Concord, Lincoln.
Sudbury. Carlisle and Sudbury.
Sudbury.
Yeah, Sudbury had.
Really?
Parts of Sudbury, I thought.
I don't think so. Part of Lincoln came to us.
Lincoln.
I think they had Charlie Dale was from Lincoln. I remember that.
Yeah, they had a choice. I think he was right over the line. Maybe. We went to Lincoln to see Charlie Mail. Maybe he lived on the edge. I don't know. He lived in Concord on Middle Street, and then I think they moved to Lincoln later on.
Well, I have a friend that lives in Sudbury who went to school in Concord. So maybe parts of Sudbury.
At least that's what he told the Sudbury officials.
Yeah, right.
You know, I would notice in some of the write-ups in your old yearbook, particularly under a girl's name, it would say plans to go to college. Mm-hmm. The expectation, unlike today, was not there. And I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
But the high school was sort of organized around, you almost had to make a choice whether you were going to go on to college or not, because they had college courses with, you know, and then commercial, and I forget, you know, they were sort of, all of a sudden as a freshman, you were almost making that decision whether you were going to go on to college or whether you're going to go on to a technical school or go to work, they had vocational, sort of tracking, so that sort of, in some sense, segregated, I think, people too early, in my opinion. But it was very much an individual thing. I know in my
what happens in a lot of Europe today, even mm-hmm. today, in, you know, modern Western cultures, Japan too. I mean, the decisions are made at a very, very young age.
And the percentage of I haven't looked at it recently, but the percentage of students from Concord who are going on to a 4-year college is much higher than it was in our day. I saw that fairly. But I remember when I took physics, I was one of two women in that class, and I bet today it would be 50-50, but it wasn't considered a choice for a woman to take physics.
I remember there was a big debate about that, Barbara, whether we were going to let you in that class.
Mr.
Ben,
like,
did they let guys into homemaking?
Yeah, I think
did
so.
They? I didn't remember.
Homemaking.
Yeah. I didn't remember.
Well, they came and ate the goodies.
Well, that was auditing the glass.
But very clearly, the expectation
very clearly, yeah.
Wasn't
and I think
there.
If my family didn't have the expectation for me to go on and pursue, I'm not sure the school would have been there for, you know, saying that. But,
yeah, that's a good point.
My parents the school really getting, insisted you know. That I take those tougher courses. And I had to really argue with them. Guidance counselor to take physics.
Let's turn to the type of clothing or hairdos or that made your era pretty distinctive.
You know, I was listening about that the other day. No one wore slacks to school. You didn't
Never.
Wear dungarees ever. Had always a skirt. I think the guys mostly wore chinos or that kind of, but they never wore jeans either. And just wasn't there. And the big thing was the penny loafers and the little neck scarf, the around the neck tied, this little short scarf.
And sweater.
You wore a scarf under a blouse, collar your blouse,
right.
And tied it.
Yeah.
It was very uniform, when you think about it. I mean, anybody, and those who sort of strayed outside that, you know, were looked on, you know, oh, you wore a leather jacket.
on the waterfront.
Very uniform.
But when you went to church, you had to dress up.
Wore a hat. Always a hat, gloves. And hat and gloves. Didn't even go into Boston without wearing gloves. My father always wore a hat, a fedora, not a... I don't remember seeing baseball caps in school.
No.
You know, everybody wears a baseball cap now. But that was not part of... You had to be on a baseball team to wear a baseball cap.
Let me look at that picture. I'm just kind of curious. We probably get dressed up for that picture.
In Catholic churches, every... At that time, women always wore a hat when they went to church.
Something
had
on your head.
Had to have a hat.
You had to have your head covered.
Right? Yeah, had to have your head covered when you went to church.
It was, I think, for a young man, it was the DA haircut or a crew cut.
That's true.
Crew
cuts were very common. I still have it. I can't get over it. Some people never grow up.
Well, and I remember I worked a summer in Filene's in Boston, and you were not allowed to wear a sleeveless dress or blouse. You had to have your arms covered. And had to wear stockings. Quite different. No pants. Allowed. Clerk in the store.
You didn't have casual Friday?
Nothing.
There wasn't such thing.
It was uniform. Everybody was pretty wore chinos and shirts, and I'm not sure whether white bucks were in them or not, or out. I can remember. Certainly in college they were. But that was kind of like the uniform.
Well, that 8th grade picture I have, somebody has saddle shoes on, so I think saddle shoes were coming back.
Saddle shoes, exactly.
Wow.
They were there. Yeah.
I remember the penny loafers.
But I mean, it's sort of interesting because even though it was not a uniform, I mean, some schools, like my daughter's school, that was a uniform. All the girls wore uniforms, but it was not mandated. We just did it. So. Informal uniform, but pretty much everybody wore the same clothes.
And the skirt length was not, it was like calf length, it was not short.
You can see that.
And when we had proms, we all wore long dresses, fairly covered up, too daring.
Linda sent me this, I don't know how many of you have seen it, because I didn't know what a grand march was, and she showed me what it was.
Do you remember that?
Oh, now I do.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I'm looking at a picture at the old, I believe.
Where was that taken?
It's the Industrial Arts School that we had there. They had a woodworking class, a machine shop. They had an auto mechanic shop there.
And today that's the Emerson. What they call the Emerson Umbrella Building.
Uh-huh.
And the other class they had there, for a reason I don't know, they had the physics class there.
Really?
On the second floor.
Uh-huh.
Can I see that? Where is it?
It's the school.
Oh, yeah.
Building right
next
to it.
That's right. Yeah. I remember that.
I'm going to turn to something now that reflects the era. We moved in 50 years ago to a nuclear age, and that meant, you know, a certain amount of fear of, you know, nuclear armaments. To another extent, there was the promise of things like atomic energy, but this was definitely the Cold War, the Red Scare, a nuclear age time. And Dorothy, your father was involved in civil defense.
When we lived in Concord, yes, and when we moved to Acton, 1957, I think it was around 58, 59, just around 1960 when they were having trouble with Cuba and all the rest, the neighbors got together because that's when they decided to build fallout shelters. And he and the neighbor went to Harvard, where they had the Civil Defense Office, got blueprints on how to make fallout shelter. It was made with cinder blocks. I don't know the exact dimensions. And they were put together, like you were making a brick wall and so forth. And then it was plastered over. And it went in a certain area, so radiation couldn't get in.
you had to have your supplies for 3 to 7 days, which consisted of water, a transistor radio, flashlights, extra batteries, blankets, canned food, and a Sterno stove to heat your food, and also maybe a couple of chairs to sit, you know, chaise lounges or whatever to sit on to rest. And to make sure you're all clear on your transistor radio.
And there were air raid drills.
Yes.
I remember those distinctly.
Yeah, I remember.
All the lights used to go out, you know. And at that time, during those air raids, everybody had to paint the top of their headlights black. It was halfway of the headlight, the top of it was painted black.
World War II.
That was World War II. But
you know, it's interesting because that was World War II, and the air raids were World War II. But your era, what you're talking about, wasn't so much 53 and 54, it was 5 or 6 years later, because I remember Nelson Rockefeller in New York was big on bomb shelters and so forth. And so I think, I mean, it's very true, and you experience it here, but for me, I was long gone by the time that bomb shelters got popped. I was long gone from Concord by the time they got to be a big issue.
But civil defense was a part, because I remember I was, for some reason or other, I was one a part of the neighborhood group, and my father had some responsibilities. He was head of food services at Middlesex. Middlesex was designated as a place where people could be fed. And he would meet with town people, you know, to plan whatever was going to happen. So it did happen in the early 50s, but I was still in high school then.
They may have been called fallout shelters.
Yeah, I don't know about the fallout shelters. I don't know about the shelters, no. But I remember the civil defense, what you were supposed to do and how the town was supposed to be organized.
Yeah, there was civil defense
drills and so forth, and where people were supposed to go. But it was amazing. I never had a fear, though.
No.
I never thought something really was going to happen, as opposed to today with the terror. You know, I think there's a fear that we know something terrible can happen here. And we had all the civil defense, but I never was in fear that it was really going to happen.
Did you have the take cover drill, you know, where you went under your desk?
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we had that.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
But I don't remember under the desk. In high school.
No, I remember in grade school fire drills, but I don't remember anything in high school.
By the time high school, as I remember, it was more the communists, threat of communists, and the big driver
history.
In history. I remember in Spanish class, and constantly we spent more time talking about communist dialogue that went on rather much more than we did about Spain or about the Spanish. So, it was very close. It was always a division, a real division in the country, and certainly in my own house about you know, how many communists there were. Where they were, how big a threat they were, and as opposed to, you know, exaggerating the whole thing, you know, this guy, the senator from Wisconsin, was a madman. It was a big, big discussion. And you look back on it now, I do, I think, how could we have been so stupid to think all of this stuff? But in those days, that was very much in the headlines, and it tore apart a good part of the country for a while.
Did you watch the McCarthy Army hearing?
Yes,
my history class watched it. I don't know if any in the spring or June of our senior year, were you in that history class? And she actually asked us to watch.
Maybe.
We had to watch
maybe,
McCarthy.
Yeah.
We were asked to. I don't know if we.
Yeah, they didn't have it in.
Not
at
the school, but
the
we
school.
Were told to. We had a report on the McCarthy hearings. That was very, very much of a part of our history discussion. And I remember there was one professor who lived in Comanton who was accused of being a communist, and it really hurt his family. He felt he was a friend of mine, one family, and it was devastating. And it was written up in the paper, and on, you know, he was not a communist. I think he had gone to some meeting or something, but McCarthy and as well as a number of other Harvard professors that became communists. It was a very terrible time for some people. I remember the McCarthy hearings very well. I thought he was horrible.
it's interesting. I didn't, you know, we all paid attention to it, but it wasn't the most prominent thing in our lives. It didn't seem to be, but I can remember we had a track meet with Ringe Tech. You know, we used to go in there, and of course you went through, or Cambridge Tech or something that was in Cambridge.
Ringe Tech.
Yeah, I was in Cambridge. I remember somebody said, as we went through Harvard, they said, you know, they don't let you in here unless you're a communist. You know, I mean, those are, see, that doesn't sound right, but maybe, you know, it's a good thing I'm going to Dartmouth. You know, so, you'd kind of hear it in the oddest ways that you wouldn't talk about it, then something would come up like that. I wasn't remember
by
that.
By innuendo and, you know. Kinds of pervasive stuff.
People lost their jobs. I mean, they really did. And Conantum, as you remember, was built for faculty members, you know, by Harvard. And I babysat there for one of the, he was an architect, but from France. And he was being accused of being a communist. And he escaped that. But it was very real. And McCarthy did a lot of damage. A lot of people, I think, unfairly.
Well, I think even in the movie theater producers and directors, they were
backball
from
the Hollywood group.
Yeah.
But I remember watching
screenwriter for High Noon.
And Welch,
yeah,
the lawyer,
mm-hmm.
And the finally that really was
he was the hero.
That was the defining moment. Mm-hmm. He says, have you no shame, sir?
Yeah, I remember that.
Shame. What you've done to this man. I mean, just McCarthy started to shrink down at that point. He became
nobody
after a while. Right?
Hated.
Well, hated, yeah, but I mean, he was not featured in the newspaper anymore. I think he loved being hated as much as he loved being loved. As long as he was there, you know, as long as he was part of the scene. But when nobody paid attention to him, that was the worst thing.
Well, I guess by December of 1954, he was censored by the U.S. Senate. And but that 1954 year was very,
very
crucial, you know, because that was the height, the hearings, and then the...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
My brother was at Harvard at the time, and I think that's probably why it made such an impression on him, too. There was a lot of turmoil there. He brought that home.
Sure.
You mentioned the Conantum neighborhood, and that was quite a different neighborhood for Concord. And there were a lot of comments or feelings about it. Do you recall that?
I do, because it was very modern in construction and design. This Jean-Paul Carillon, who was became head of the architecture department at Harvard, but he was a professor at that time, and he had designed some of those homes, and he was roundly criticized because they, you know, they were not colonial. They were these very, very modern design, and people were offended by that at the time. Some people.
Were they deck houses?
No, they weren't deck houses.
No.
They were just modern
style, modern.
Very open style, you know, where the living room, dining room were open. And they used space very well. I think that's why they were cheap to build.
They didn't have any bases, did they?
No.
I recall there was a lot of young people.
Young academics.
One of them got flooded right on the river there. I think some of them got flooded when the river was overflowed. Yeah.
Since you mentioned the river, was canoeing, the boathouse, was going along the Concord River or Sudbury River, were these favorite pastimes
for
any of you?
Yeah, the South Bridge.
Southbridge Boathouse.
I mean,
still there.
Yeah. Probably the bridge too.
Yeah.
But I remember going there as a kid, and that's where I learned how to boat. That's where I actually got my love of boating there. I've always loved boats ever since then. And I grew up there learning canoe first, and then a motorboat. What is Scott Atwater, 7.5 horsepower engine, all the way up to Fairhaven Bay. Day and a half trip. The same day. And no, it was terrific. I think the river, in my way, played a big role in everything that I enjoyed about the town. The rivers, it was the Concord River, Assabet, and the Sudbury. It's unique. It's wonderful.
We used to, the river on Sunday afternoons with the girls, we'd go down there and take the canoes and paddle all the way up to the bridge.
I forgot that.
And see, like, coming back, it was paddling uphill.
Sunday afternoons, I forgot that. We did that, yeah. And I remember, not the river, but I remember walking from Sudbury Road to Lake Walden, crossing Route 2, and walking through the backwoods to Lake Walden, and walking around Lake Walden. That was, I'm not sure I'd try that now. It seems so safe to do it at that time. There's no fear. At least I did not have any fear of walking alone at night or woods or anywhere in Concord. That's quite a change.
No, because I used to babysit for a family over on Elm Street, and I had to babysit at night. I walk home. You know, I just go. Nobody bothers me. Paddle.
That's a long walk. Part of Elm Street was it? Oh, which part of Elm Street was it?
This is the side of Elm Street.
Oh, okay.
You know, where Elm and Main.
I
used to walk up to Howard Johnson from my house. Mm-hmm. Never thought anything of it, no. Yeah. Two or three of us would walk to Howard Johnson on a Sunday afternoon.
28 different flavors.
Yeah. I mean, you never had to worry about anybody stopping or anything.
We used to, I enjoyed the canoeing mostly. What we did. Didn't do it an awful lot, but I remember reading the Thoreau's Week in the Concord and Merrimack, and then I read within the last year, someone had redone that route, following the journals and trying to go around up the Concord to the Merrimack, and what it was like described then and what it was like now. It was a fascinating story, because obviously in 150 years or whatever the difference is, it was a vastly change.
About Lake Walden, I think that's changed a lot in 50 years too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Used to do a lot of fishing there. A lot of good trout on that pond. I mean, opening day, I can remember April 15th, I think it was. I mean, that place was literally surrounded by fishing. Mm-hmm. Now you don't see as many. You do see some.
Isn't that very, very deep?
Walden
very deep.
In the middle, yeah, it is. Some areas are really deep, yeah. There was always a story way back that pond and White's Pond was connected underground somehow. There's always a story, but there was never any proof.
White's Pond.
White's Pond.
That's where we lived in the summer.
Used to serve hot dog and hamburgers. It was a fast food place. I mean, you wouldn't call it fast food today's definition.
This is at Walden.
Walden, up on the, along whatever that was, 126 or whatever it was, by it. And that was 7 days a week, 90 cents an hour, serving hot dogs and hamburgers, and that's all, pretty much. Maybe some French fries. And 12 hours a day, and it was great, because of course you couldn't have no time to spend any money, so you could actually save it, you know.
You had a little white hat, too, didn't you?
I think I did.
There was a trailer camp right behind there.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Right by the trailer camp.
Trailer camp there. I think part of it is still there.
Yeah, but there's probably just one trailer left, you know, because you can't add to it anymore.
They reconfigured all that area right in front of the farm when the state kind of took it over, I guess. But at one time you could just walk right down in there and not have a problem, and all that area was all parking area. Now they made everybody park on the other side.
That's right.
Makes it more difficult to get there.
But I think the freedom to just roam around town, that was very much your era.
I remember growing up on the farm, one of our treats as kids, after my dad used to tell us if we finished weeding all the rows of tomatoes, he'd take us over to the Lake Walden to go for a quick dip in the pond. You know, that was a big treat for us when we were kids. And I remember that distinctly.
Did they have the fees? They didn't have the...
No, there was no fees.
Fees then, yeah.
We just parked and went down.
Yeah.
We didn't go very often, but that was our treat.
Some of you certainly came a long distance to this reunion, but the very fact that Concord has this tug as a hometown to you, and everybody likes to feel they belong somewhere. Could you remark on that, about Concord, your hometown?
I think is wherever you go, people have always heard of Concord, Mexico. So you say, well, I grew up in Concord, and immediately they have a picture of what it's like and what it is like. And I think that's part of the reason why you always feel that's your home.
Yeah, that's true. Even as far as the West Coast, I mean, people would know about Concord. They don't pronounce it correctly, but that's it.
Concord.
I was out fishing about 2 weeks ago, actually. A buddy of mine, he said, what are you going to be doing? Oh, I know, we're playing the golf. I said, no, I can't do it. I'm going to be going back to my reunion. He said, oh, really? He said, where was it? I said, Concord, Massachusetts. He says, where? I said, Concord, Massachusetts. Oh, you mean Concord? He says, I was out there 2 years ago, and I loved it. People love the place because it's probably in part because, as you said, AZ, because it's of the historical significance. But more than that, I mean, it's more than that. It's a comfortable place, and it was when I grew up, when we all grew up, it was a safe place. I mean, it was a place where somebody said earlier, you left our doors unlocked all the time. I don't ever lock in the doors unless we were going away for a long vacation or something like that. And you could walk safe and go everywhere. And it was small enough so that you knew a lot of people. You know, you were not just a number, but you were a person.
Mm-hmm. And you knew people, people knew you.
You knew people, they knew you downtown. If I had a little problem, which occasionally I might have, Chief Ryan would call my dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Right.
Sergeant.
And it smooth things over for you, you know. And you take care of you, which was nice. Nice to know that. You know.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen.
Well, that's what bothers me today. At one time, you could go downtown and know almost everybody in the town. Now you cannot. You don't even know anybody, you know.
Yeah, the story
those people knew who you were. If you get into trouble, you got reprimanded by them. Plus, when you got home, your parents would reprimand you. So.
Your parents knew what was going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether you told them or not, because some neighbor, I mean, all that, I walked a mile from our home to the center of town, and, you know, all those neighbors knew who I was. And we knew the police chief. He knew us. We knew the senior people in town knew us. And it was a very safe environment. At least you didn't think about it not being safe. It was the absence of fear rather than thinking I am safe. You didn't even think about it, as a woman especially.
People watched over one another. They kind of
they did.
Kept an eye on everybody.
When they introduced me to the head of the Board of Selectmen?
Yeah, chair of the Board of Selectmen.
Yeah, today. So.
And
I don't remember knowing them when I was here. One day I get to know Renee and I get to...
Our neighbor was a selectman.
And she's a woman.
Yeah, definitely. Well, what I loved about Concord is the look of the place. Unchanged in 50 years, you know. Mm-hmm. For me, nothing has changed. Now, you know, so much of America is a mall, and everything is homogenized, and you could swap this for that and the other. But Concord is unique, authentic, individual. That's the look that you get. Now, I haven't checked any stores. Dominic has said that a lot of the stores are so upscale, a lot of people can't afford them, or they close all the time. Why don't you? Touch on that, because again, you can't see that just as a visitor. You have to check out
the store. You're looking at the look of the town.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very identifiable.
Yeah, the identifiable look, but maybe not in what's in those stores.
Yeah.
There's no 5 or 10.
There used to be the corner drugstore.
I was just going to say
Snow's drugstore. And then
Richardson's
was on the other side.
Yeah.
And they're no longer there. One's the toy shop and one's the leather shop.
And I think the both pharmacies were real cornerstones, and they had what appealed to you as teenagers.
They were hangouts.
They had a soda fountain.
Definitely hangouts. I mean, there was a place that I remember going to school afterwards. You either go to Richardson's or Snow's. I think I would mostly hang around Richardson's for one reason or another, because I think maybe Brooks worked there. Somebody was a soda jerk there. But anyway, you know, it was fun to eat. You could stand outside and watch the passing parade.
And if you wanted a Coca-Cola, they would mix you the Coke right there.
Cherry Coke,
and they had the syrup and the soda water there, and that's how you would get a Coca-Cola, not in a can.
We always used to get through school at 10 after 2, and we knew that practice would start at 3. So if you ran down there really quick, you could stop at Sally Ann's. And you get a regular donut or a nickel or a jelly donut or a
jelly.
Then you go to the drugstore and get your Coke or cheese crackers, whatever, and then make it back with 3 o'clock.
To practice. I was just going to say, we did that routinely.
Yeah.
And they were...
Yeah, the old-fashioned counter. And
right. Counter. And they would say, well, how's your dad today? You know, I mean, they knew the family. It's very different. And I sort of followed the Concord through the years, because my parents lived here till 1996. And it's been subtle in some ways, but there have been real changes in terms of the growth, just the population growth. The cost of housing has made it more homogenized.
But you don't see it when you're in this downtown sector.
You don't see the change of ownership, the change of stores, and what it meant to people living here. You know, the more expensive stores and the lack of a drugstore. The drugstore was not there.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant, you know, it really did change the way you thought of the town as you lived through those years. It's still a wonderful town, no doubt about it, but it's different. It's different. It's wealthier. Housing is more expensive. Everything is more expensive. And I think you had a more diverse population in the 50s than you have today.
More people could live in Concord.
More people could live in Concord.
Yeah.
By the way, you mentioned stores. The Vanderhoofs is celebrating 100 years on the Mill Dam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, we had to go on the Concord Journal yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
My mother still gets the Concord Journal.
I still do. Even though I live out of town, I still get it.
She does too.
Whatever happened to the Enterprise and the Monitor, or whatever the third one was? Are they still around?
And the Concord Journal is part of a larger group called Community Newspaper.
It covers all the area towns.
But at least there is a community newspaper.
Yeah.
I'm going to thank you for your participation, and I wish you just a wonderful weekend for your 50th reunion. It was a distinct pleasure meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you. The house that we lived in, it had, I think, maybe 5 apartments. But we had a big one in the front side, and right behind us was 2 old maid school teachers, one of whom was Miss Dyer, who was a science teacher, I think. English at the school. Well, she was old then.
We would have
a lot of summer parties, and at summer parties they would always give cheers to Miss Dyer, and her garbage can was her very favorite, so they would always put something in her garbage can, and then as soon as my mother and father came home, she would make a beeline to tell them exactly what had happened, and then they'd say, okay, don't worry about it, but she was a legend in herself.
We had some wonderful teachers.
How about Minner and Maud Van Dyson?
Great school. The one I wanted to mention was Miss Goodfriend. Now don't you three guys sit here and tell me you don't remember Miss Goodfriend.
Oh, she was, well, sort of
glamorous.
Glamorous, yes. Yeah.
She was young and blonde,
reddish blonde,
and well developed. And they used to go.
What class did she teach?
You mentioned it.
Business. Good
friend. Oh, that's the reason.
Oh, oh, you all knew Miss Good Friend. I remember that sort of thing.
Was she having a spark in the
I don't remember Miss Early.
And then David had a player piano in his home. And if you were really lucky, you got to David. We were invited to, as a group, to David's house, and we played that player piano. And Charlie Napoli could not pump it.
Charlie Napoli had a problem with that.
He could not pump that.
Big, strong, bruising guy. But he never could catch on the timing of the pedals for that. Charlie, you're a good lineman, you can walk, you do everything. You can't pump the player piano. You can't know everything. So I'd play it for him.
That's one thing that kind of distinguishes our era, because we were just a little before rock and roll. We're just on the cusp of rock and roll. And at that time, Broadway shows were very big, and it certainly was important to our family. I know My Fair Lady was just coming out then. We all had the long playing records and that sort of thing of the Broadway shows, and we did that. My mother was had 18 years of voice lessons and taught piano and so forth, was the one who, and I'll show you the picture because I have it up here, but my sister did this, who would rehearse Three Joes and a Nose. And a Three Joes and a Nose, this is from our high school paper, were Charlie Mayo, Charlie Napoli, Bob Davidson, who was not in our class, the class behind us, and yours truly. And she would rehearse us, and we sang at the football banquet.
But I played the piano for you one time.
I think you did.
Yeah.
I think you did.
Yeah,
that's right.
And you even rehearsed at my house one time.
But in any event, the sad thing about that is I'm the only one left of those four.
I forgot about that.
And David was in a band, too, that I called him about in high school.
Your first husband was the best trumpeter we ever had.
Well, I played piano with Bob for a graduation. He played a solo. Do you remember that? That fantastic trumpet lullaby.
Oh, my.
Trumpet lullaby.
Was a very good
David, what was your...
You did, Barbara, but see, I remember my mom rehearsing those. I'm
sure you did. I mean, yeah, no, I only played the piano one time, I think. It was a.
But you always sang it at the.
For you, but I remember that. Oh, I forgot all about that.
And David, you tell Renee what your group was and what you played.
We had the logarithms.
That's great.
Yeah, and I played the one string bass, washtub bass, and what else was in that?
How about the old minstrel shows that we used to have?
The same week.
Yeah.
At the Monument Hall.
And then talent show in high school.
Charlie was.
They used to have one every year at the.
Charlie was
at the Monument Hall. Yep. The end man.
I met a couple of years ago, and he had had a very, very difficult life. I think one of his kids.
Who died?
Charlie Mayo.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he lost two wives. His kids had had problems. That's right, the Down syndrome kid. And Charlie got very, very strongly religious at the end of his life, which he hadn't done earlier.